Between about 970 and 930 BCE, some 3,000 years ago, King Solomon, the second son of Bathsheba and the 10th son of David, ruled the third and last king of the ancient kingdom of Israel. The Bible tells us so. During his reign, at a festive Passover meal with his ministers, King Solomon teased Benaya, his arrogant chief of army. "Benaya," King Solomon said, "I was told there is a special ring that has a special power. It can change how a person feels. A sad person becomes happy when wearing it, and a happy person becomes sad. I know you, of all people in the kingdom, can find the ring. Go then, fetch this ring, and bring it to me by the eve of Sukkot, 6 months from now. If it exists anywhere on earth, your majesty, I will find it and bring it to you," replied Benaiah. King Solomon smiled. He knew no such ring existed, but he wanted to give his minister a taste of humility. Time passed. Benaiah sent soldiers and messengers throughout the kingdom, examined records, consulted with elders, yet he could not find even a hint of the existence of this magic ring. Spring passed. So too did summer. The last harvest of the year, and with it, the Sukkot festival was approaching. Then came the eve of Sukkot day. With only a few hours to go before sundown, Benaiah was wandering the streets of Jerusalem. The sun cast a magic light on the city of gold. All the merchants were busy with their last sales and preparing to close their stalls. Benaiah turned to an old silversmith. "Have you by chance heard of a magic ring that makes the happy person forget their joy and the broken-hearted person forget their sorrow?" he asked. The silversmith listened carefully and smiled. He took a plain silver ring from his old and dusty box and engraved something on it. When Benaiah understood its meaning, his face lit up. "This is the ring," he cried, and gave the poor jeweler all the money in his purse. "Come to the palace, and you shall have more, for I cannot thank you enough." The sun had set. The time for the holiday dinner had arrived. That night, the palace was full of guests, ready to celebrate with their king. "Well, my friend," said King Solomon, "have you found a ring that can make a happy man sad and a sad man happy?" Everyone who knew about the search for the impossible ring laughed. Solomon himself smiled. But to everyone's surprise, Benaiah held up a ring and declared, "Here it is, your majesty, I found the ring. It has three Hebrew letters engraved on it, Gimel, Zayin, Yud." Then he whispered the meaning of these initials in the king's ear. As soon as Solomon understood the inscription, the smile vanished from his face. He looked at the guests filling the banquet hall, the tables covered with shining serving pieces, silver goblets, the finest food one could find. Tears rolled down his eyes. He felt sad. The entire hall was in total silence. A ring that makes the king cry? Then King Solomon looked at the ring again, and he started to smile. He laughed so hard he infected the entire palace with giggles and laughter. Everyone wanted to know the meaning of the initials. The king revealed to his guests what was written on the ring. The three letters are Gimel, Zayin, Yud, representing three words. Gamze Yavor. Gam, meaning also, starts with a Gimel, which in cursive script looks like that. Ze, meaning this, starts with a yain, which looks like that. And yavor, will pass, with a yud, that looks like that. Remember, Hebrew's written from Left to right. Right to left. Right to left. I got that. So now you know what your new little pebble is telling you. I invite you to keep it handy. Maybe in your pocket or on your desk or nightstand or taped to your phone where you surely see it hundreds of times a day. I first heard this ancient Jewish fable as a young child. And I heard it again and again because it was my mother's favorite. A woman of intense complexity and an enormous vocabulary, she had an index card taped to her bedroom mirror with only these four small, simple words on it. This too shall pass. So when Ricky reached out for summer speakers this year announcing that fables would be our theme, I signed up immediately. I just knew I wanted to share this particular tale and take the chance to explore the reasons why it was my mother's favorite fable. My mother was born in 1941, graduated college at 18, had three children in her early 20s, got her PhD at 30, and became the first woman tenured in the psychology department of West Virginia University at 36. Her field was gerontology. Let's have some fun with this. She published this book at age 39, Transitions of Aging. She designed this wraparound jacket cover with a picture of a cradle at this end and a flower representing a grave at this end. And she would draw that on the blackboard of the first day of her adulthood and aging class. That's what she always drew on the blackboard. She asked her young students to fill in what happens between death and birth. Her young students had no trouble filling in the first part of the line with the various stages and transitions of life as they had already experienced them. But between having children and dying, the most they could generally come up with was menopause and midlife crisis. So my mother would then tell her students that she was going to help them learn that there's a little more to adulthood and aging than that. It's easy to understand why she was so captivated by the fable of King Solomon and his magic ring. Time is what ages us. And my mother spent her life studying the aging process, unpacking what happens between midlife and death. The women of my mother's generation, and many other generations, including today's, and many other genders besides female, for that matter, are taught that time is not on your side, that you must fight any and all signs of aging, do anything you can not to look your age, and by all means, lie about it. Deny the depth of your life's experience. As a matter of fact, if Hallmark were any indication, you better start bemoaning your fleeting youth and your alarmingly advanced age at 30. But not my mother. She embraced time. Her youthful appearance genuinely annoyed her. And she truly believed. It may also have limited her professionally. Who here knows what it's like not to be taken seriously by someone who thought that you were too young to know what you were talking about? One time, I remember my sister, mother, and I being introduced to a man who immediately claimed to her with a very self-satisfied smile, "These can't possibly be your daughters. The three of you must be sisters." She was so insulted, she slapped the guy. And she did stuff like that, but that is another sermon altogether. But why was she so outraged? Because her years of mothering us were hard-earned. She considered her children among her most glorious crowning achievements, of which she claimed many, and no one was going to take that away from her. And besides, she couldn't wait to age. Instead of dreading it, she actually looked forward to it. She used to joke that one reason she married my stepdad, a man 14 years her junior, was that when she was an old lady, she'd have someone to push her wheelchair around all over Europe. My mother was a scholar who studied, understood, and worked really hard to prove that with age comes wisdom. With age comes perspective and patience and fortitude. With age comes more and more opportunities for greater and deeper reflections. Think about it. Age equals experience, which gives you a broader horizon from which to see life's challenges, a bigger lens for unpacking life's mysteries. But my mother did not get to age. In fact, it's sobering to realize that by the time my mother reached the age I am today, she'd been dead for nearly a decade. Naomi Nancy Dutton died at 46. I was 22, and it was my very first great, big, huge, devastating loss. But lucky for me, she helped me get through it. In the months before her death, she prepared me. She assured me that my grief, too, shall pass. She gleefully told me and everyone else around her that geniuses die young. Just in case there'd previously been any doubt about the matter. She relished one of her very favorite poems by Edna St. Vincent Millay. My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes, and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light. Incidentally, in her dying days, she also gave her 32-year-old soon-to-be widower and his 3 adopted adult children some very specific instructions as to how we were going to go on living the rest of our lives. And here it is, my pulpit confession. I didn't follow them all. And that's also a different sermon. But I like to think that the fierce rebel in her would secretly be proud of my insubordination. And since it's entirely up to me, that's exactly what I've chosen to believe. Most of us, dare I say, all of us, have faced the death of someone we love dearly. And so we know my mother was right. Over time, that initial excruciating pain gives way to a gentler grief, a milder mourning, then a longing, and ultimately, just maybe, if we're lucky enough, mostly nostalgia and warm memories are what remain. As Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, a Swiss-American psychiatrist, pioneer in the study of death, she wrote the groundbreaking On Death and Dying, frames it, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. In other words, this too shall pass. When you lose someone or something that you have loved and cherished, time is on your side. And since we can't ever, never, no matter what, stop time, it's a good thing to have on your side. But here's a problem. Remember King Solomon's magic ring? It doesn't just make a sad man happy. It makes a happy man sad. So, please bear with me and trust me and close your eyes. Think about the first time Or maybe the last time that you fell in love. Remember that blissful ecstasy, cloud nine, right? That all-consuming thrill of a kiss, a touch, a caress. Remember when just one look... Okay, that's your cue. It's okay to open your eyes. Remember when just one look was all it took? Remember when being next to that special someone could make you go all Twitter-pated? Boy, I sure do. The last time, which was the very best time that I fell in love, my world got turned positively upside down, in the best possible way. And if you know that feeling, then you also know this too shall pass. However, if we're lucky and we work very, very, very hard at it, sometimes that honeymoon phase makes its way to an enduring love. An enduring love. The kind of love that led Chuck Harris to publicly declare from this very pulpit on just this past Memorial Day weekend that his wife of 39 and a half years, Glenda Parsons, was the co-author of his life. That doesn't happen overnight. Now, for those of you that may not know, it was their enduring love that helped make it possible for us to be here in this chapel today and many yesterdays and many tomorrows. It was Glenda and Chuck, along with two other couples, Leslie and Bob, who have moved to be with family in Colorado, and Chris and Dean, who have both died in body but live on in our hearts and memories, made it possible for UUCL to purchase this building decades ago by putting their personal credit on the line for the loan. So maybe that heart-palpitating, breathtaking passion of head-over-heels love does, alas, fade in time, but look what boundless joy and endless hope an enduring love can accomplish. So, if it's time and only time that can make hopes and dreams come alive, why do we fight it? Why does it seem like we're constantly in a race against time? We are told, time and time again, that as we age, time is not on our side. Did you know that the global anti-aging market grows at a compound annual rate of 7.8% between 2013 and 2019. Did you know there was a global anti-aging market? I'm not making this up. Products, anti-stretch marks, anti-wrinkle, Botox, services, hair restoration, chemical peel, anti-pigmentation therapy, devices, laser aesthetics, microabrasion. This market amounted to $122 billion in 2013, and it's expected to reach over $190 billion with a B this year. A lot of people are telling a whole lot of other people that signs of aging are not okay. And a whole hell of a lot of people are buying it. Why aren't we proud of the gray hair and wrinkles we've earned? Why do we believe that we should not let show how time has taken its toll? Time is what we want most and what we use worst, said William Penn. Do something besides killing time, because time is killing you, said Pablo Coelho. The trouble is, you think you have time, said the Buddha. But the Buddha also said this: do not dwell in the past, do not dream of the future, concentrate the mind on the present moment. And so with that, let me take you back a few weeks. See what I did there? Never mind. Suzanne got it. A few weeks ago, our president, Jenna Korf, was in this pulpit to talk about the fable of the three blind men and the elephant, each holding a different part and disagreeing vehemently about what this thing was, this thing they could not see. She talked about moments of conflict arising from limited perceptions, about how a pause, a mere moment or more of time, can evolve your truth. Now, who among us has ever flown off the handle, saying or doing something in haste, only to regret it later? As my dearly beloved and long-suffering wife, Sandy, will tell you, that has never, ever happened to me. But I have heard that it happens to others. No, seriously, Sandy, you'll be happy to hear something that I truly believe, something that Reverend Alice told us in her sermon a few months ago, to who it may concern. She said that it is said, I preach what I need to hear, and I allow others to listen. And what Jenna said in her sermon was to put time on our side in those moments of conflict. Listen to all the perceptions, beliefs, and conclusions that seem to be clashing. Conflict involves vulnerability, she said. Enter it with curiosity. Choose to take that opportunity to expand your personal search for truth and meaning. Or as my wife likes to say, allow your world to get bigger. Maybe you never or hardly ever fly off the handle, but if you do have other old bad habits that are hard to break, no problem. It's easy. Easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, recognize it afterwards. 2, recognize it in the present moment. 3, recognize it before it happens. Simple. Just put yourself on the right side of time. The week before Jenna's sermon, Ricky was here with a message on perspective and fighting the natural inclination towards negativity. He inspired us to open ourselves up and in that instant, in that moment of judgment, to allow time for other thoughts. He also asked us to think about when something bad happened in our lives that actually turned out to be good in the end. Because this too shall pass. And it's not just Ricky and Jenna telling us this. Our covenant of loving relations says the same thing. Now, thank you, Ricky. For those who don't know, this is our covenant of loving relations. Normally it hangs on the back wall right under the clock. And it was stewarded to unanimous congregational approval by our most recent past president, Alan Benkofsky, along with Ricky. In other UU congregations, they call this the behavioral covenant, or the whole church covenant, or the covenant of right relations. But here at UUCL, thanks to our very own and most beloved Irv Dubinsky, we have called it our covenant of loving relations. And here's what it says. I'm not going to read it all. To covenant in loving relations with one another is to engage in the spiritual and everyday practice of loving better. In times of growth, we will use our covenant to deepen our bonds with one another. During times when we are loving well, it will inspire us to love better. And in times of conflict, we will use it to guide us. And on that point, here's what it says towards the bottom, more specifically. We agree that conflict is a natural part of congregational life. In times of conflict, we step back and reflect on our feelings. Step back, reflect, pause. But how do we hit pause? Because you can't stop time, right? No, as surely as the sun will rise tomorrow, you cannot stop time. But you can choose to put it on your side. May it be so.